This has actually turned into a three-part sermon, so tonight's not the end of it. I'll be preaching again next Sunday night. So just by way of review, and maybe for those who may not have been here last week, the topic is the limits of Satan's power. And just by way of review, some of the things that we discussed last week. We talked about how that Satan is a very formidable adversary. And the word Satan actually means adversary. And 1 Peter 5:8 talks about Satan as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And so, because he is a formidable adversary, we need to understand how he works, how he operates, what his tactics are, but also what his limits are. And we talked about last week how that some people have the erroneous idea that Satan is an equal polar opposite of God. And while he is a polar opposite of God, in that he is the source of evil and he is the father of lies, whereas God is the source of good and all truth, he is not the equal polar opposite of God. And we talked about how that God alone is omnipotent, that is to say, all-powerful. God alone is omniscient, that is to say, all-knowing. And God alone is omnipresent, that is to say, ever-present or everywhere at all times. Satan is a created being, and because he is a created being, he could never be equal to God in terms of glory and honor and power. He certainly is in no way equal to God. We talked last week about how that some people believe that when things happen to them, bad things happen to them, and I use the examples of, you know, they break a leg or they wreck their car or their car breaks down or they lose their job, those kinds of things. A lot of times people will say things like, Satan's really working on me, or, you know, they have this belief that Satan is causing these things to happen in their life. And when you read the book of Job initially, you might get that idea. But I do not believe that that is the case today. And I started making my argument for that last week as we briefly reviewed the story of the book of Job and pointed out that the power that Satan had over Job was limited and it was temporary. It was the rare exception and not the rule. And we went on to talk about some of the limits of Satan's power in last week's lesson. We talked about how that Satan does not have control over the physical realm as God does and as Jesus did when he was here upon this earth. He just spoke to the wind and the waves and told them to hush, be still, and they immediately calmed down. And the reason Christ had that kind of power over the physical elements is because he created the physical elements. Satan does not have that kind of control over the physical elements. We talked about how that Satan does not know the future. We talked about how that Satan cannot touch us without God's permission. He couldn't touch Job without God's permission. He cannot kill us. Satan does not know our thoughts. Satan cannot make us sin. And we looked in Revelation chapter 20 about how that because of Christ's victory on the cross, Satan was bound with a chain, it says. Of course, it's a figurative chain. It's not a literal logging chain like you'd have in the back of your truck. But he was bound with a chain, figuratively speaking. And how that, like a dog on a chain, if you don't get near that mean dog, he can't bother you. And the point that I made was we need to keep our distance from Satan, stay as close to God as we can. And the closer we are to God and the closer relationship that we have with God, the less we have to fear from Satan. I also brought out the point from Revelation chapter 20 that there will come a time when Satan will be loosed for a short time, the Bible says. But even when he is loosed, his power will still be limited to deceiving the nations. Even when he is loosed. And I wonder if perhaps we're not living in those days when he has been loosed. Because when I look around and I see what's going on in the world and all the madness, it makes me think that maybe Satan has been loosed and he is up to his deceiving of the nations for that short period of time. I don't know that. I'm not a prophet. Don't claim to be. But even during that time, his power will be limited. So that reviews last week's lesson. And I'd like to explore tonight. I'd like to talk some about why God allowed what he allowed to happen to Job to happen, and why God allows bad things to happen to people sometimes. And then also, the last part of the lesson, which I'll cover most of that next week, we'll be dealing with some passages, some specific passages that people use who do believe that Satan even today has the ability to harm us in physical ways. I want to deal with some of those passages and offer what I think is an explanation to why those passages do not teach that. Let me say that some of my own brethren who disagree with me on this topic, I have great respect for them. They are faithful Christians. They are serious Bible students. And I don't claim to be an authority on this topic or any other, as I think I mentioned last week. And some of the people that would disagree with me on this, I have great respect for them and for their knowledge and their faithfulness to the Lord. At no time has Satan ever done anything that God did not know about in advance and that God did not allow him to do. When Satan came to Eve in the Garden of Eden and tempted her, God knew in advance that Satan was going to do that. And God knew in advance that Eve would yield to that temptation. Now, someone might ask, if that's so, why in the world would God have allowed that to happen, knowing all the grief and misery that would be brought on the world by that one defiant act? And Joe touched on it in his lesson this morning when he talked about, did God harden Pharaoh's heart, or did Pharaoh harden his own heart? And he made the point that the same sun that melts wax also hardens clay. The same commandments that he gave that softened some people's hearts hardened Pharaoh's hearts. And it really has to do with the fact that we are creatures of free will. And when God created us, he created us in his image, and we are creatures of free will. That's true of human beings, and it's also true of the angels. They are also creatures of free will. Now, why is that important? Well, love is something that cannot be legislated. And love and faithfulness only have value when they're given freely. Let me try to illustrate that principle. When I was a little boy, I remember, I think my sister had one, and maybe some of the other girls that I knew in the neighborhood had a doll that had a string, a pull string, on the back of the doll. And you'd pull the string out and let the string go, and the doll would say, "I love you." You pull the string again, let it go, "I love you." Does that doll really love the little girl that owns the doll? That doll is incapable of love. That doll is made out of stuffing and material and a little voice box in the back with a string. The doll is incapable. But God could have created us that way. He could have created us like a programmed robot to do everything that he wants us to do exactly the way he wants us to do it, when he wants us to do it, without ever questioning it. But how would that have honored him or glorified him other than the fact that he was capable of creating such things? When we love him willingly, that honors him. If a man is married to a woman and his wife tells him, "I don't love you. In fact, I love this guy, Larry, down the street. And I'm going to leave you and I'm going to go live with Larry." What if that man takes his wife and puts her in a closet and locks her up and keeps her against her will and says, "My wife's being faithful to me. I'm forcing her to be faithful to me." Well, we all see the ridiculousness of that. If that woman wants to go be with that other man, there's not really too much you can do about it. I mean, if she's just set and determined, she's going to do that. Her faithfulness to you, her love for you, and vice versa, only has value when we do it willingly. When we do it because that's what we want to do. That's why God created us. Creatures of free will. And so God knew what Satan was going to do, and he knew what Eve would do. But without the choice, there's no value in that love and faithfulness. So the question arises, does God still allow Satan to harm people in a very direct way today as he did in the circumstance of Job? And I don't think there's any way that we can prove that absolutely one way or the other. So I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. But I don't see anything in the Bible that would suggest that God still allows that kind of thing to happen. Although there are passages, and we're going to look at some toward the end of the lesson, most of them next week, we will get to a few of them tonight, that people use to say, "I think this passage teaches that Satan, even today, can inflict pain or so forth on us even today." But we'll look at those a little later. So why did God allow Satan to do what he did to Job? Well, I can't say with absolute certainty all the reasons. God may have had some reasons that there's no way I could ever know. You know, I don't know the mind of God. But I think that we can deduce some of those reasons from the text. But before we look at some of the reasons as to why God did allow that to happen, let me say that I can say with certainty that he didn't do it because it was something that he got some kind of twisted, distorted pleasure out of. God doesn't work that way. Ezekiel 18:32 says, "I take no pleasure in the death of anyone." We all know and understand, the Bible is very clear that God is a very loving and compassionate God. He's a merciful God. And in Lamentation, what am I not doing, Ray? Well, while Ray's doing an exploration, I'll just read from Lamentation. Lamentation chapter 3, starting in verse 32, it says, the book of Lamentation, in case you don't know, is a lament about the destruction of Jerusalem. And in verse 32, and it says, "And if he," the he there referring to God, "and if he causes grief, then he will have compassion according to his abundant loving kindness. For he does not afflict willingly or grieve the sons of men." Verse 33, "For he doth not afflict willingly or grieve the children of men." That word willingly there means from the heart or inner person. In other words, it's not what God takes pleasure in. When God does have to discipline or whatever, he doesn't do it because he takes pleasure in it. He does it because it's necessary. I don't often quote commentators, but I will quote Adam Clark on this particular passage right here. He says regarding these two verses, it is no pleasure to God to afflict men. He takes no delight in our pain or misery. Yet, like a tender and intelligent parent, he uses the rod not to gratify himself, but to profit and to save us. And I think that's accurate explanation of that passage. I know as a child, my parents, and I remember my father saying stuff like, you know, this hurts me worse than it does you. And I'm thinking, yeah, sure it does. But then when I became a parent, I understood what he was saying. You know, when I would discipline one of my children, if I spanked one of my kids, I didn't take any pleasure in that, but it was the thing that was needful in the moment. So God's allowing men to suffer for whatever reason he may allow someone to suffer. It's not because he gets some kind of twisted, distorted pleasure out of it. So why did God allow what happened to Job to happen? Well, one of the points that we made last week was possibly, and again, I can't be dogmatic about this, but maybe to point out to Satan, to say to Satan, you know what? Job is doing what you failed to do. Job has been faithful to me. He has shunned evil. You didn't do that. But also, I think, to bring honor and glory to himself through Job's conduct, through Job's life. Also to illustrate the limited wisdom of men. And I think that book demonstrates the limited wisdom of men very well. When you look at Job's friends, they all had it wrong. Every one of them had it wrong. They were judging, each one of those men were judging Job unrighteously. And they were actually judging God unrighteously as well. And even Job himself, later in the book, in chapter 19, he says some things that would indicate that he felt like that God was not being fair with him, not treating him justly. So the book illustrates the limited wisdom of men. But another reason, I think, is because it provided for the world Job's great example of faithfulness and of God's sovereignty, both. Untold millions of people have benefited from the lessons taught in the book of Job. And if time goes on, many, many more will benefit from it as well. So those are some of the reasons, I think, why God allowed this to happen to Job. God had a reason. He had a purpose. There's always a reason or a purpose behind what God does. He doesn't just arbitrarily do things on a whim. So the question comes up, would God allow Satan today to do something similar to what he allowed to happen to Job? And I've said already that I don't think you can prove it one way or the other, yes or no, but I believe that what happened to Job was an extreme rare exception to the rule. And perhaps a one-time historical event. What would be the point in God's allowing someone to suffer like that today? We already have Job's example recorded for us in the book of Job. There are not going to be any additional inspired writers to record such an event. And I realize that these are my opinions, and that's all they are. So you don't have to, you know, accept them hook, line, and sinker. But I think, from my understanding of what the Bible teaches about this, I think that that's correct. Somebody might think to themselves, God is allowing Satan to do this to me or to do that to me because of some sin in my life. But if someone's thinking that way, they need to stop and remember that God did not allow these things to happen to Job because of some sin in his life. Actually, these things happened to Job because of the fact that he was a righteous man. That's why they happened. God pointed Job out to Satan. Have you considered my servant Job? And then Satan said, yeah, but it's because you build a hedge around him. Or, yeah, but let me, you know, touch his body and he'll curse you. But Job didn't. Job passed the test. We could also ask the question, why did God allow Jesus to go through what he went through? And somebody would say, well, that's an easy answer to that question, Earl, because, you know, Jesus had to come to this earth and die on the cross to save us from our sins. And that's true. He did. I agree with that completely. But why did he have to suffer such a cruel death? Why did he have to undergo the physical and verbal abuse that was hurled at him prior to his actual crucifixion? This was the only begotten Son of God. And again, I can't say with absolute certainty all the reasons, but I think some of the reasons are that Jesus, or God wanted Jesus to undergo what he went through to show humanity what it looks like when someone really puts God first in everything they do, holding back nothing. And that's exactly what Jesus did. The life that he lived and the death that he died brought honor to his Father, brought honor to himself for the perfect life that he lived and the perfect death that he died. His whole life and his death and his very death itself, all he wanted to do was please his Father and serve humanity. When Jesus was hanging on the cross, he was not thinking of himself. He was thinking of others. He was thinking of the two criminals that were being crucified on each side of him. He asked God to forgive the very men who actually crucified him, because he said they know not what they do. He talked to John about taking care of his mother. He was thinking of his mother while he was hanging on the cross. While he was hanging on the cross, he was thinking of you and he was thinking of me. And so he honored God in his death. And Jesus underwent what he underwent to illustrate that man could not save himself, and to show our utter dependence upon God for our salvation. Now, some passages that are oftentimes used to try to illustrate that Satan perhaps may today be able to afflict us in some way. I want to look at just a few of those tonight, and then the lesson's going to be yours. And the first ones I'm going to look at are related to demon possession. Some people say, well, demon possession, you know, we read about demon possession in the New Testament. And so if someone is possessed by a demon, isn't that a way for Satan to inflict harm on people? Well, before we actually look at those examples, let me just go back to the Old Testament and say this. Satan is only mentioned 19 times in the Old Testament. 17 of those 19 mentions are in the book of Job. So he's only mentioned two other times. Now there is a reference to there's a prophecy against the king of Babylon where he is referred to as Lucifer. Some people say that is also has a double meaning, is also referring to Satan. I'm not convinced that is the case. But also there is no demon possession mentioned in the Old Testament. It's not there. We see demon possession in the New Testament, primarily in the Gospels. So let's look at a few examples of demon possession. Am I waiting too long between times, Ray? The bottom one? Okay. Mark chapter 19. They brought the boy to him. When he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." I cannot deny that when someone was demon-possessed, I can't deny that there was physical harm brought to them oftentimes. And I think in most cases that was true. This demon tried to destroy the boy. Oftentimes he tried to destroy him. And I think what that's saying is tried to kill him. But he was not successful in that. And I don't see any example in the New Testament where a demon ever was able to take a person's life. I don't think it was ever allowed. God did not allow that to happen. But certainly demon possession took place. Another passage, Luke 13, starting in verse 14. But the synagogue official, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, began saying to the crowd in response, "There are 6 days in which work should be done, so come during them and get healed, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him? And this woman, a daughter of Abraham, as she is, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day?" And the question is, how was she bound for these 18 long years by Satan? Well, we have to go back to the beginning, or a little bit earlier in that chapter. Verse 10 says that he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who for 18 years had had a sickness caused by a spirit, and she was bent double and could not straighten up at all. This woman was possessed by a demon. That's why she had this issue. That's why it was an issue that was of Satan or by Satan for these 18 years. But the bigger question, and if you would open up your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We're going to look at a passage here on the board, but I think I'll back up and read just a little bit more. The bigger question is, does demon possession exist today? We cannot deny that it existed in the New Testament. The question is, does it exist today? In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, this is oftentimes referred to as the love chapter, but really the main thing that's being talked about in this chapter is miraculous gifts. And in verse 8, the Apostle Paul says, "Love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away." So he's saying these miraculous prophecies, these miraculous tongues, this miraculous knowledge, all these miraculous gifts that you, some of you Christians are able to perform. You're able to perform miracles because you have received this miraculous gift by the laying on of the apostles' hands. There's going to come a time when that's going to come to an end. And it is my belief and conviction that when the ability to perform those miracles came to an end, then things like demon possession also came to an end. And I'll make a further point about that in just a minute. But he says here that we, can I back up? Yeah, we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. The perfect there, that word perfect means complete. And I believe this is a passage that's speaking about the completed revelation. They didn't have the New Testament. The early church did not have the New Testament. They didn't have that luxury like we have today. And the miracles were given for a limited and temporary period of time, just like Satan's powers against Job were temporary and limited. But the miraculous gifts were given for a limited period of time for an express purpose, and that was to instill faith in the hearts and minds of the early Christians. And we're going to look at some passages that talk about that. But that which is perfect has come. That which is in part, that is, the miracles are in part, will be done away. All right. In Acts chapter 8 and in verse 18, there was a man who was a sorcerer. His name was Simon. And he obeyed the gospel. He was baptized. And he saw some apostles lay their hands on some people and give them the ability to perform miracles. They laid their hands on them and gave them that ability. And Simon saw that and he coveted it. And this is what it says about Simon. And when Simon saw that the Spirit was bestowed through the laying on of the apostles' hands, he offered them money, saying, "Give this authority to me as well, so that everyone on whom I lay my hands may receive the Holy Spirit." And of course, we know that Peter tells him that he has no part or portion in the matter. But only Jesus Christ himself and the apostles and those people on whom the apostles had laid their hands and transferred this power, only those people in all of human history have had the ability to perform these miracles: miraculous prophecy, miraculous knowledge, speaking in tongues, casting out demons, and so forth. Only they had that power. So when Jesus died and went back to heaven, and the last apostle died, and then the people on whom they had laid their hands and given this gift died, there was nobody left on earth who had the miraculous gift of casting out demons or any of these other miracles that could be performed. And so when the ability to perform the miracles ceased, I believe that the demon possession also ceased, because it had a limited purpose, and that was to instill faith. The performing of these miracles instilled faith, and we're going to look at a couple of passages that I think illustrate that point very well. John 20 and verse 30, "Therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." Then in Mark 16, starting in verse 17, "These signs will accompany those who have believed in my name. They will cast out demons." So that was one of the miraculous gifts, casting out demons. And let me stop and make a point right here. When Jesus cast out a demon, or when an apostle cast out a demon, they walked up to him and said, they just told the demon to leave, basically. They just walked up and said, "Come out of him, come out." And it happened instantly. It was not any of this nonsense like you see in the movie Exorcist. I didn't see the movie, but when I was in high school, that's when that movie came out. I didn't want to see it, I didn't go see it, but I heard kids talking about it. And, you know, evidently this Catholic priest comes and he's an exorcist, and he has the ability to cast out demons. And it takes him days to get this demon to come out of this girl. And there's furniture floating around in the room, and the windows fly open, and the curtains fly up. That's a bunch of Hollywood nonsense. When Jesus cast out a demon, he said, come out, and he came out. And if the apostle said, come out, he came out. It was just simple as that. But they had the ability to cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will pick up serpents, and if they drink any deadly poison, it will not hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. So then, when the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God, and they went out and preached everywhere while the Lord worked with them and confirmed the word by the signs that followed. That was the purpose of signs. That was the purpose of miracles, was to instill faith. Now, when the miracles ceased, the New Testament was being written during this time. Then they had the New Testament coupled with the Old Testament scriptures to instill faith in their hearts. The miracles were no longer needed. So, the fact that there were no demon possession in the Old Testament, we only see it in the New Testament. And the fact that those demons were cast out by people who had miraculous abilities, and we no longer have people with miraculous abilities, it just stands to reason that the demon possession does not exist today. That's our time. I'm going to stop right there, and we'll pick up with some other points, some other passages, and just take them one by one, and we will finish next week, I promise you. So, the song of invitation that Dave selected is 276. If there's anybody here tonight who's not a Christian, I would encourage you to think seriously about that. It's the most important decision you'll ever make. If there's someone here tonight who is a Christian, who needs the prayers of the congregation or feels a need to come forward for whatever reason, we would encourage you in either case to come as we stand and sing.